I'm happy to be back in the studio after nearly 2 weeks out on the hills and the plains of Kenya. And I have to admit, I was there as nothing more than an awestruck tourist. I spent days and nights out of reach of most of my usual information and distraction sources, and it was a once-in-a-lifetime trip. I saw animals every day, you know, wherever I turned, that had populated my children's books and fantasies and Animal Planet. But whenever I could, I did read the local newspapers, and while I was there, the Kenyan legislature passed and sent to the president a bill that would force journalists to reveal their sources. Sound familiar? And there were two major dailies in Kenya, The Nation and The Standard. One, the more liberal one, the conservative, think, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And the first time that I got a look at them, The Nation had a big front page story on this bill and freedom of the press and how are we going to fight corruption when sources have to be revealed and so on, and a planned protest by Nairobi's journalists demanding the president veto this bill. Now, neither the bill nor the planned demonstration were even mentioned in that day's Standard. Okay, front page story in The Nation, not even showing up in the entire Standard. But a few days later, the next time I got a look at a newspaper, the front page had a photo of a handful of journalists leading this march with tape over their mouths, and two of the five in this front page picture were wearing Standard T-shirts. So journalism and journalists, I salute you. Now, in that same August 16th issue of The Nation, the Kenyan's Daily Progressive, I read an op-ed about the Kenya presidential election. And a writer named Charles Onyango Obo wrote, and I'm going to quote him, "The candidates will do well to go out and buy a book entitled The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation by Drew Weston." Now, that was in an op-ed in the Kenya's Nation. I returned to find that the August 8th Guardian of London had run two long excerpts of The Political Brain. And this past Sunday, the book was a leading review in the New York Times Review of Books. Yesterday, it was the lead article in Salon.com. And today, Drew Weston, the author of The Political Brain, will be my guest. I'll briefly quote Onyango Obo on the message from his op-ed. "Weston has studied elections over the years and found an inconvenient truth. People almost always vote for the candidate who elicits the right feelings, not the one who presents the best arguments." And with Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez resigning and the good ship Bush having fewer and fewer rats left to jump overboard, I believe Weston's message is all the more important. I have long referred to Rove and company as electoral savants, remarkably gifted at demonizing and defining opponents and winning elections, but seemingly uninterested and incompetent at governing. But winning elections is job number one. And are the Democrats going to be able to seize the moment in 08? Can they win? How big can they win? And if they do, will it matter? Drew Weston received his BA at Harvard, an MA in social and political thought at the University of Sussex in England, and his PhD in clinical psychology at the University of Michigan, where he subsequently taught for 6 years. For several years, he was chief psychologist at Cambridge Hospital and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. He's a commentator on NPR's All Things Considered and lives in Atlanta, where he teaches at Emory University. His book, as I said, is The Political Brain. Welcome, Drew Weston.
Thanks for having me on.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. Now, your PhD is in clinical psychology. You were chief psychologist at a hospital. What was your path to this current focus on politics?
You know, it's a great question. I think it's one I've never been asked in about 200 radio interviews. You know, it's funny. As a clinical psychologist, I'm a researcher. I do research in psychology and neuroscience. But I've also been a practicing clinician for 25 years. And one of the things that's been most surprising to me in some ways is how smooth the jump is from listening to patients talk. I do study personality disorders, and so there's an easy move from studying personality disorders to you know, politicians. But
right.
But aside from that, it's what you do as a clinician is you're listening for when people are talking with you. You're listening to hear what's whirring in the background. You know, what thoughts and feelings are connected up in the back of their heads that are leading them to do things that they wish they could stop doing, whether it's a pattern in a relationship that they wish they could stop but they keep doing, or that they have an eating disorder and they're binging and then purging by throwing up. What you're listening for in the background is what's worrying, and you're also listening for things that they're in conflict about. And really, in many ways, the thing that has made the transition most sort of easiest for me has been that you're listening for the same thing in politics, or you should be, for what is it that that's worrying in the background when people get angry about immigration, or when they they're only two flags burned a year, but they cast their votes based on flag burning. What you want to know is what's getting triggered, and that's the piece that I think is really continuous between my life as a clinical psychologist and now as a political strategist and advisor.
I really appreciate that. Without going into Thomas Frank's book, What's Wrong with Kansas, his big question was, why do people vote against their own self-interest? And that's the same thing that a clinical psychologist is looking for, isn't it? Why do people behave against their own self-interest?
Absolutely true. And it's funny, over the last year, I found myself speaking to a lot of Democratic and progressive organizations, and particularly donors who've been giving lots of money to the Democratic Party and watching it go down the tubes. And I almost invariably would get the question from somebody, which would be, so what's the matter with Kansas? How come people are voting against their self-interest? And my response was often the same, which is, what's the matter with you? I mean, you're here. You are in someone who has the wealth to contribute to Democratic campaigns, which means you're in the Republican tax bracket, and you're voting against your own self-interest. You're doing it because you have values, and that's the same reason that a lot of voters in Kansas are voting. And the role of a leader is, as much as anything else, to set the emotional agenda for what values are really most central in this election year. And that's where I think Republicans have been so much more effective and Democrats have been so much less effective in the last 40 years.
Right. So values. I think that turnaround, your response is excellent. Okay. So we asked why you focused on politics, what drew you to that. That's still a big leap to why did you write this book?
You ask questions that make me think you must have been a psych major as an undergrad.
I went to Harvard and I majored in social relations.
That's great. And for anyone who doesn't know, social relations and psychology were connected departments.
Exactly.
At Harvard. What really made me do it, to tell you the truth, was that I was, I've always been interested in politics and have always followed it carefully. And I still remember to this day sitting in my living room watching with a group of people, Michael Dukakis offered that horrible answer about what he would do if his wife were raped and murdered, which Bill Maher has summarized well as whatever. but what really got me into doing something about it and writing this book was having two little kids and looking at the world that this administration and at that point the Republican Congress, who was pretty much rubber stamping anything that he asked for, we're doing to the world that we were leaving my kids, and I just couldn't stand it anymore.
Okay, let me up the ante for a second, Drew. As I mentioned in my introduction, you and your book are everywhere these days, right? I told you that op-ed in the Kenyan Daily Nation, New York Times, this place, that place, etc. You've touched a nerve. People want to know what you've got to say. Two questions. Why do you think that's so? Why do you everyone writes a book hoping it matters, but you have touched a nerve. And then the fact that you've not only got a book, but you got a book with buzz gives you an opportunity. What are you hoping to accomplish with this moment?
Oh, those are two great questions. Well, the first one is, much as I wish I could say, well, of course, it's a brilliant book, and that's why people are reading it. I'm enough of a scholar of intellectual history to know that that the times are often ready. It's the term for it that you'll remember from your old Harvard days is the zeitgeist. that there's kind of ideas brewing in the air that are waiting for somebody to articulate and spell out systematically. And I think in some ways that's all I've really done, is to take an idea that many of us in our guts understood, which was that when Democrats talk about things, when they talk about, when I say to you the environment, do you feel anything? Probably not. If I say to you, consumer affairs, do you feel anything? No. You know, you go through the list of the words that we use on the left to describe the things that matter to us, you have no idea that they matter to us. And the idea that emotion is central to everything that we do in politics, that it's what arouses people's interest as well as their motivation, the idea that values actually matter and that people on the left have values just like people on the right have values, and that the difference between them is not that one has them and one doesn't, but that we have competing value systems and we ought to be enunciating exactly what those are so that people can make a choice. I think those are things that people were waiting for somebody to say in a way that they could hear. And so I suspect that if people are buzzing about the book, that's probably mostly why.
And that second question, now that you realize, you know, golly, they're listening to me. I'm not just speaking to an Emory classroom. I've got the ear of some people with power, some people with money. You've spoken, I know, with Obama, Edwards, and Clinton people. When you're driving alone home in the afternoon in that Atlanta traffic, what is it you hope you can do with this moment?
Well, really, two things. One is just in general to get them to rethink the words that they use so that the next time they want to talk about the environment, instead they think about how to talk about that in a way that's emotionally compelling to people so that they'll care. I mean, you know, right now we have 20% of pregnant mothers have enough mercury in their systems to damage the brain of their unborn children. Why don't we talk about that when we talk about the environment? You know, those are the kind of things. I mean, I just heard the House Minority Leader here in Georgia, who is a Democrat, because the Democrats are in the minority, say the other day in a wonderful speech, you know, I'm so tired of talking about the environment. Let's talk about the fish. I want to be able to eat the fish that my son and I catch in the streams of Georgia again. There's a way you talk about appealing to rural America. That's how you appeal to rural America. So that's the first thing I'd like people to hear. And that message, I think, is getting through.
Mm-hmm.
The one that's harder to get through because it runs against so many years of electoral history. It runs against the grain of the way Democrats have been thinking and taught to think for many, many years is that the best policy tends to be radical honesty, and that if you find yourself having trouble doing things like defending the Constitution or protecting American troops from being slaughtered in a war where they don't belong in somebody else's civil war, if you're having trouble voting for those for the things that you believe in and talking about them in a way that people find compelling, then you need to find a better way to talk, and that language is probably more the language of honesty and the language of emotion than it is political calculation. Because I think that the most devastating thing that Democrats are continuing to do right now is to cast votes for bills that they don't believe in because they're afraid that they're going to get branded as something or other. And if you spend your time worrying about what the other side's going to say about you instead of saying something about yourself through your actions, you're going to lose a lot of elections.
Yeah, let me make first a comment and then a question. And that was that when the vote came up on reauthorization and they sent Bush a bill he vetoed once, and then they sent it back and they caved. I wrote to my representatives and said, you are behind the people of Iraq and the people of the United States on this. They already, you know, you will be applauded for courage if you stand up to him rather than being afraid to be seen weak by not supporting the troops, that the people already know that. But let me skip to in the 08 campaign, I got the feeling about halfway through that one of the distinct advantages that Bush had, this is in my gut, was that Bush seemed to be saying what he actually believed, and Kerry seemed to be figuring out what to say. And whatever you thought about their positions or their arguments, he seemed authentic, and Kerry, like Gore before him, did not. How does that perception fit what you're talking about?
It fits in exactly with what I'm saying, which is that what the data all show are that all voters are values voters. The biggest influence on people's voting behavior is their feelings towards the parties and their principles, which means that if you don't enunciate your principles, which Democrats have not done effectively in over 40 years, with the exception of the Clinton years, where Clinton talked explicitly about values, about opportunity for all, responsibility from all, and community. I mean, he was very explicit about that, whereas most Democrats have not been. And, you know, on the major wedge issues, Democrats are consistently trying to be as quiet as they can, whether it's gays or guns or abortion, because they're afraid that the people aren't with them.
So when they have issues that touch emotions, they get nervous.
They get nervous. And when they get nervous, they run. And what people see is that they run and they look like they are searching the polls for their principles. And the reality is that they are. And if voters reject a party that says, I'm not going to tell you what I really believe on this, or I'm going to hedge and get defensive, or let's not talk about abortion. I want to talk about Social Security. I think the voters are picking up something accurate.
You actually say that deeds matter more than words, even though we've been talking about words, and that the way that a Democrat responds in a debate or the way they respond to these issues, that makes a huge impression. And people are, from watching that, deciding how they'd respond in a confrontation with another country or in a crisis. Is that pretty fair to say?
Yes, it is. I think, frankly, the way you answer a question in much of America about abortion actually has more of an influence on what people will think about you on national security than how you answer it on national security. I mean, if you project cowardice to people, if you back down when the president says boo, it doesn't matter what words you use. People get the message that this is a person who is afraid of aggression and doesn't know how to stand up to a bully. And do you want somebody who doesn't know how to stand up to a bully running your foreign policy? I don't think so.
You actually, one of the things you do in the book that's entertaining and I sense was fun to write was you sort of say the speeches I wish they'd said.
Right.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, sure. An example would be when George W. Bush presented his protection of marriage amendment to the Constitution in 2004. And essentially what John Kerry did was to issue a little press release that was quiet and that he hoped would be, he and his team would be essentially buried in the news, that said, this isn't very nice. That was the extent of the response, and all it did was to embolden the enemy, to use the Republican language. It led the Republicans to figure out that they could then put anti-gay ballot initiatives on the ballot in 10 or 15 states, and those initiatives actually carried the election for them. So,
what would you have said?
Well, I would have had John Kerry come out swinging, and I don't mean to ignore the electoral reality that people have prejudices against gay people. And I also don't mean to ignore the reality that a lot of people have religious beliefs about, you know, what constitutes marriage. I mean, you know, we don't force Catholics to marry divorced people in their churches. And I don't know too many people who would force Southern Baptists to marry gay people in their churches. Democrats never say those things because they're too afraid to touch the issue. So I think what Kerry could have done very effectively was to answer George W. Bush in the very same idiom he was using, which was a religious one, by beginning by saying a religious and a patriotic one, by saying, Mr. Bush, that was one of the most un-American, hateful, blasphemous things I have ever seen a president of the United States do in my lifetime. I don't know what God you think you're worshiping, but the God that most decent Americans worship and the God that I worship is a God of love, not of hate. And he would never countenance building hatred into the sacred Constitution of the United States. And you owe every American, and not just gay Americans, every American, an apology for trying to wrap hatred in the language of sanctity.
Great. Okay. And for people who want to see more of those, they're in the book, The Political Brain by Drew Weston. Let me, before I lose you, we got about five more minutes here. You now have set up shop as a political consultant, people listening to you, but you describe in the book some of the actual clinical research that backs up your theories. This is not just stuff that comes, you know, off the top of your head. Can you tell us about that at least that key study that people are referring to, so people get a sense of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's the book is filled with research, and it's really about How would you run a campaign if you started with a 21st century understanding of how the mind and the brain actually work? And that's really why I decided to write the book, was because I was watching Democrats run campaigns over and over that seemed mired in a bad understanding of 18th century philosophical understandings of the mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is the idea.
And why not use what we know?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's an irony that Republicans actually know the scientific research that bears on elections very, very well, and so that the party that governs with faith and intuition tends to campaign with science,
uh-huh.
and the Democrats, the party of science, tends to campaign with faith and intuition. The study that I think you're referring to is a brain imaging study we did in 2004, where we were interested in the way partisan Democrats and Republicans responded to threatening information about their candidate. And the quick version of it is that we presented them with threatening information, partisans with threatening information about Bush and Kerry, and watched what their brains did in action, and essentially gave them reasoning tasks where we first presented one slide they're reading that about their candidate. It sounds something good from him, and then the next slide comes up that's usually his own words contradicting himself or something else showing that it was really looked like a slimy thing to have done. And then we asked them to consider whether or not there's a contradiction. And what we found was that, that partisans did a wonderful job of standing by their man. They were able to twirl the cognitive kaleidoscope until it came up with emotionally gratifying results. And, they ended up believing what they wanted to believe. But the fascinating thing was to watch what happened in the brain as they did it. And the most important, probably two things I can say about that are, one is that the reasoning circuits did not turn on.
Say that again.
Yeah, that when they were supposed to be reasoning about, if slide one is true, can slide two also be true?
A reasoning question.
Simple reasoning task. If A, and B are they compatible or incompatible? They were always designed to be incompatible. So
yeah.
Can A and B both be true? The reasoning circuits that have been shown to be active in dozens of studies where you give people reasoning tasks. Those were essentially the dead zone. What turned on instead were circuits involved in emotion, particularly distress, and emotion regulation attempts to turn off that distress. And the partisan brain was remarkably adept at doing that. So, the major conclusion of it all is really the sort of central point of the book, that the political brain is an emotional brain. It is not a dispassionate calculating machine. And if you try appealing to people by listing all the picking the right issues that are at 60% in the polls and listing all the facts and figures behind them, and the other side is using emotion effectively and talking about their values, you are pretty consistently going to lose.
Okay, now we don't have time, and I'm going to give you about 30 seconds or so to answer this last question. We don't have time to go into your take on the current candidates, but if people go to that Salon.com article, you do that quite well, and you actually critique current commercials of many of the candidates. So people, if you're interested in that. But let me just say that you say that Democrats should go back and look at Jim Webb's response to the State of the Union. Let me finish with that. Why?
Because what he did was to he was able to wed reason and emotion in just the ways that are most effective in elections. That is, just to give an example from that address, he made this statement. He said, when I was in college, the average CEO made 20 times what the average worker in his company made. Today, that's 400 times. What that means is that your CEO makes more in one day than you make in an entire year. Now, why is that effective? He's using numbers, and a lot of people have said,
right.
Oh, Weston's saying that we shouldn't rely on facts and figures. But what do those numbers do? They immediately elicit two things. One is a value, fairness, and the second is a feeling, which is, this is not right. And it gives you a sense of righteous indignation. Well, those kind of moral emotions are central to the electoral process, and they ought to be central to the electoral process.
Okay. And Jim Webb, as you know, is a former boxer and a former soldier. So he comes by this well. Again, the book is The Political Brain. The website is thepoliticalbrain.com. Thank you, Drew Weston. Keep up the good work.